Let's go.
You're listening to Making Data Simple, where we make the world of data effortless, relevant, and yes, even fun.
Peter, thanks again. Welcome to the show. We had some glitches to begin. My bad. But just to rephrase, Masters of AI in Stanford, you're a founder with four exits. That means you're filthy rich. You got to tell us what it means to be filthy rich. And you're the CEO of Certify It. And that tagline comes with, you fight fake news, fake reviews, fake products. Welcome to the show. I would appreciate it if you'd give us a little history, tell us about yourself, and we'll put my crappy lead in aside.
Al, thanks for having me. And no, you can do a lot of companies and not be rich. And the reason is because the investors always win. And so there's a whole other episode just to talk about the perils of negotiating term sheets when you're raising money and planning for scenarios you might not anticipate. But anyway, yeah, I am still at it. And my newest, my history has been kind of product focused, coming at companies and problems with a kind of a product mindset. You know, the AI masters from Stanford 30 years ago was completely lying idle until suddenly in the last couple of years, we have this boom of generative AI. So at least the degree is relevant again. And, all my companies.
You just were ahead of the game, 30 years ahead of the game, Peter. That's awesome.
I was just a geek who totally wanted to build robots and stuff like that. I mean, that was really what was going on. Because doing computer science in the 80s, now everybody, the cool people do it. It was not a cool thing back in like 81. And at Stanford, the master's in computer science program that was only 2 years old at the time with the AI component. Yeah. So anyway, dating myself horribly. But yeah, so my background has mostly been starting these companies, and then they did all get acquired. As I mentioned, the investors usually did quite well. And now I am really using everything I've learned to try to do some good with it. And one of the biggest things I'm concerned about with AI is the rise of deep fakes and the inability to know what's real. And Certify It is basically a tool to fight back against that.
Can you give us an example of a few of the companies that you took public, or you took to be acquired, I should say?
Yeah. So first one, wineshopper.com, massive 1999 bubble company. Jeff Bezos and Amazon invested $32 million. Michael Mondavi, invested $1 million. Yeah. Kleiner Perkins, which was the top VC at the time. It was like my 15 minutes of fame. I was riding on corporate jets with Martha Stewart and who brought Borscht onto the plane, and I made me sit on her, didn't make me sit on her lap, but I sat on her lap, took a picture. She said, no, come right here, honey. But anyway, lots of stories came. And, meeting with Jeff Bezos quarterly was pretty exciting too. You know, I don't think I would get a response if I reached out to him now, but.
At Amazon at that point in time? I guess it was.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And so we were doing.
Because he was an investor beforehand.
Yeah. So, no, he was. This was Amazon. And the deal was, because Kleiner had invested in Amazon, was to, for certain industries, they would partner for a tab on the future website. At that point, Amazon was still books. And so they had Wine Shopper was going to be the wine tab on Amazon. And that meant that we got all sorts of help from them, including, we built a 20,000 order a day automated pick pack center for wine, the first of its kind in history. It could handle 20,000 orders a day, but those never came because the bottom dropped out and the company got sold really by the investors because they panicked. So then I went on, and after, okay, I just had the most spectacular failure in front of the most important people in the world, because even though it got acquired, it was a that was when dot-com melted down, and nobody, it was just forced shotgun weddings. So after I climbed out of that pit of depression, I then went on to start more companies, and they got increasingly successful. The best was Telio, which was less than 18 months of work, and it was sort of Skype on steroids as Skype was brand new, and Microsoft AOL, which was relevant at the time, Yahoo, which was relevant at the time, and Google all kicked the tires, and two of them went to M&A, and suddenly it was sold for $23 million on $2 million raised. And that was pure timing. Wow. 6 months later, all we did is we had, before Skype had done it, we had inbound phone numbers, and we had click-to-call embedded in email and browsers. And so it would find numbers and make them clickable, which now is like common, but we were the first to do it, and we had patents, so these guys were panicked about Skype. And so that's where timing is kind of everything in terms of an exit.
Pretty cool, though.
Yeah, and then my most recent, I was like, well, voice over IP is working. So I did another one called Line 2, which when smartphones came out, it added a second line to your iPhone or Android phone without needing an extra SIM. And it was a full functional business line. We were the first to get that approved by Apple, which was a long ordeal, even before Google Voice got it approved. And so we got some amazing coverage, and suddenly that thing shot to the third most downloaded app in the App Store. The app still exists today. I use it every day. You can download it. It's now owned by Ziff Davis, of all companies, which is sort of doing a...
But now your iPhone, you can do two lines, can't you?
Yeah, but we're talking 2009.
Yeah. All right. Hey, that's cool. That's awesome that you thought of that.
Everyone was carrying a BlackBerry and an iPhone, because if you go back that decade, anyone who was in corporate America had a BlackBerry, and anyone who was in business had a BlackBerry, and they were not about to give up their BlackBerries. So their BlackBerry phone then became their work phone. Remember when they became phones? And then their iPhone was their family phone or their Android phone. And so instead of, I was like, why are these people carrying two phones? And that was the original inspiration for that.
I used to love the keyboard on the BlackBerry, I have to say. I still like the keyboard.
Yep. People really miss it.
Exactly. So now you're trying to solve, I guess this is a green field, but my goodness, fake news, fake reviews, that's kind of a colossal task, huh?
Yeah, and by no means am I solving it, but I am putting in a piece of the ultimate equation that will solve it. And so all that Certify is used for is right now is a app that records video that can't be tampered with. How we do that, instead of like your normal camera where it goes into your camera roll and you can go in and change the metadata, like which is location or time, you can edit it, all that. With our videos, you film it, you're forced to pin it to a map within 150 meters of where you are, and then our server grabs it off your phone and you never see the file again. And the only way you access it is through a secure link that you can share with others to view it. And that way, it's can't be tampered with. Now, use case example would be I'm about to go on a Tinder date, and this other person looks incredibly younger and more fit than they sound on the phone. And so I'm going to, or they sound spooky. So I'm going to go ask, hey, before we actually meet, could you just send me a little certified video of yourself? And then that will force them to show you exactly what they look like, as well as reveal their location. And so they kind of, it forces transparency on the other person. The challenge of our go-to-market is that it's not something you use yourself. It's something you have to get someone else to use. And in that situation, you're telling them, hey, I don't trust you. Use this to prove what you're saying. Like Airbnb is another great example. There's whole stories there of people being defrauded. And if you could just ask the host to send you one of these videos before you leave, you know you're going to see exactly what it looks like today.
I understand what you're saying. That is an interesting challenge in the go-to-market, where if you're, it's a dating app, to your point, you'd have to get somebody else to use it. But I think the use case on the Airbnb, I mean, that's a great use case. I mean, if they don't send it, then it'd be like, okay, that's suspect.
Anyway, why are you afraid to send it?
And I got to believe that, I mean, I get your point that usually you're asking somebody else to send it, but you could also send it, couldn't you, in another use case?
Yeah, during COVID, I had to return a rental car and, you know, information was spotty. And the online information said that this certain location would be open. And so I brought the car there. It was closed and I had just filled the tank and I don't want to drive it. So I parked the car there. And I showed the video to prove that it was closed at the time that I was due to return it, and was able to show them exactly where the car is because it pins the video to the map, and then emailed that to them. And there was a Dropbox for the keys. And so I didn't get charged the extra day, for example. They didn't argue with it. Now, if I had done a photo, that could have been fine, but in reality, I could have easily altered it to say I was anywhere or that it was any date. And that's the problem. You can't really prove anything with an iPhone or Android photo because all of the data is fungible.
Yeah, me. Well, I mean, I could see it if you're like, when I've rented cars before, they've had like dents in them and stuff. I'd want to get that video.
Yeah,
document. Before I take off, right?
Our goal is to get. We've already had lawyers say that a certified video matches all the requirements to be immediately admissible as evidence in court, because for a video to be admissible in court, and I'm not a lawyer, but as I understand it, you have to know its provenance. You have to know when it was filmed, who filmed it, and where it was filmed. And you have to be able to prove those. And we can prove those with every video.
Speaking of videos, do deep fakes scare the hell out of you like they scare me? I mean, they're getting crazy right now. And I was seeing one on Biden and others. And I mean, you cannot tell the difference. And right now, and I was saying this in a previous podcast, that I think it's, you know, people are using it for fun, at least most of what I've seen. Boy, if we start going medieval on this, I mean, look. I mean, he could be, you know, there with the nuclear codes or something, and somebody in the other side of the world looking back saying, what the hell is this?
You could turn on your TV and see like missiles in the air. You could see all sorts of things in any kind of orchestrated campaign that could completely deceive you. And what does that mean for democracies? You know, we already have seen what happens when people manipulate information, what happens to democracies. Imagine if you really can't tell. And that's where we're headed. So we think these are good now. 5 years from now, are you kidding me? And they're fun too, like you said. Like it was a couple of years ago, right? We had some Olympics not too long ago, but with COVID, I can't remember anything. But someone had done, curling, where they move that heavy thing on the ice and then they sweep around it. It's the craziest sport ever. No disrespect to curlers, but it's like a sport that I could probably handle. But they did a fake deep fake of curling beavers. So these were beavers that were curling at the Olympics. And if you Google it, you just Google curling beavers. Or go to YouTube.
I'll have to do that.
And you'll see it is so good. I mean, you really like, oh my God, those are beavers. You can't really tell.
I got to object to you though. I do love curling. The reason I love curling is because you can keep your beer cold while you're curling. It's fantastic. It never gets warm. right?
You can even put it on the puck. You can probably put a six.
It's terrific. It's the ultimate beer drinker's game. I love it. If
one's throwing and the rest are just sitting around commenting, it's kind of like,
well, I never got the sweeping thing. I've done the sweeping and it doesn't do anything for me. So clearly I'm doing something wrong. There must be an art to it. I'm sure I'll hear from all the Canadians. They'll tell me how to do it right. But back to the technology, sure. How do you certify the video? I got you. You're talking about pin yourself on a map. But you know, look, on most technologies, you got like two-phase commit because somebody can always manipulate something. I would imagine, can you not manipulate the pin or something? Tell me what your version of two-phase commit is.
So this is what's so interesting about this, the way we did this. And I'll tell you, this was something that happened. I always say that great products aren't invented, they're discovered. So yeah, so you're asking about certify it and how can we really claim that the videos can't be tampered with? And so I, as a good computer scientist, I will never say 100%, but this architecture is so dead simple and it wasn't something we were planning for. So to sort of position us in the whole ecosystem of people working on this, maybe that will help. There's something called the Content Authenticity Initiative. Adobe and all the other big companies are part of it, mostly Adobe is leading it. And this is a open source protocol for tracking changes in documents, whether written or visual. And there's a cryptographic embedding of the change history within the document. So the CAI, Content Authenticity Initiative, is working on getting everyone together on standards so that we can actually track this stuff. That is the battle of titans, right? There's no way a little startup can even jump into that fray to try and get these huge giants to agree on standards for this. But one of the problems they haven't solved is provenance. So they will take an image and they can tell you what happened to it once it's in their system. And, you know, so you can, it's sort of like the undo history is embedded in every document. So you could literally return it back to its unedited original form. But garbage in, garbage out. So what they don't know is if the original video or image that came in was fake, they can track changes to that, but they don't know if the original, where the original came from. And so that's the piece of the chain that we saw. We established provenance indisputably. And the only way to get around that would, like, we're not even on Android yet because we haven't figured out how to prevent people from hacking the GPS. Because with the open architecture with Android, has, as many people know, bigger security risks. And one of them is that you could alter the GPS to put the video somewhere else than where you actually are. Whereas on an iPhone, we haven't been able to get any hacker to break it. And here come the leaf blowers. I don't know if you can hear them. Or they're canceled.
Barely. That's okay. We're fine. We can handle leaf blowers as well. So here's what I heard you say. You pin yourself, so you have location, then you validate a metadata for your server, so it's tethered to your server, and then people can only access it via your server.
That's correct. They can. It's, think of it as just like a YouTube link. The way you share a YouTube video, you have a link and it streams it.
This is usually I have lines on the bottom that show the voice, but it's recording. I see the minutes going up. Let me see if I put it on.
See the lines? I can see it. Yeah, with the little level.
And you see mine going
up. So it is recording. Yours is flat.
Out.
Yours is flat the whole way. I'm just kidding.
You scared the hell out of me.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm waking you
Not
up.
Funny, Peter.
Sorry.
It better be, because I'll be free. Yeah. For some reason, none of the lines show up on mine. And I'm like, I'm starting to get nervous.
Oh,
all right, we're fine.
So where were we? You're asking about the, you know,
The two-phase commit, the certification, yeah. How you, I'm always thinking like, it's like everything's manipulated in some way these days. Of course, I think Elon has screwed this up on Twitter. Now you get three people, as long as they're willing to pay, they got the check mark. I don't get what the hell's going on there. So I'm always, I guess, suspect on some of the certification because I don't even know what's real anymore. You got deep fakes. Yeah, I'm starting to freak out now, I guess.
Yes, and you're justified because it is, it is, I mean, I know that like young people, they have built, I can't remember the example now, but my cousins, they're like teenagers and they use like everything is like for real. Like almost everything is questioned. Is that real? Is that true? They're more suspicious because they've learned at a young age that you can't believe anything you find on the internet, or hopefully they've learned that. But yeah, I mean, this is, I honestly have talked to hackers and, you know, the way you would do it is by catching people off guard. So for example, if you look closely at the link and find out, this is the most common one and you get them all the time, you'll get phishing, P-H-I-S-H, emails and texts. And in those emails, you know, they're asking for information that is sensitive. But if you look, when you click the link and go into it, if you look at the URL, you'll always work from the .com or .dot whatever it is backwards. And if that doesn't say the name of the company, then you know that's a fake link. So someone could easily do a link that's sort of, instead of, right, you know, certify it, blah, 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 it could be like a misspelling of certify it, blah, blah, blah. So those are the sorts of tricks that I think people can use. But if you're actually careful, everyone says that, you know, if the link is a link is a link, and you can't have a link go somewhere else unless, I don't know what you'd have to do, somehow get into their computer and their browser to make a link say it's showing one thing, but actually be showing something.
Do you have automation or technical validation for the videos that come in, or do you manually look through them to make sure that they look good from that standpoint? Or because of your methodology, you feel like, hey, you know, it's going to be good coming in no matter what?
Yeah, we don't have to. We do run them through an AI image classifier to look for tags, items that it can tag for searching the videos later. So you can find the videos based on what's inside them. Mm-hmm. And that tagging will then allow us, if necessary, to screen, say, inappropriate content, obscene content, things like that. But, you know, the thing is, this isn't a social sharing app. This is really, someone's asked you to create a video. Ours, the video is on a leash. That's kind of how we think about it.
Hey, so you talked about it being an app. Got that. You talked a little bit about go-to-market, but tell us about more around the go-to-market. I mean, where is the monetization come in?
Yeah, that's something I'm trying to figure out. As far as the go-to-market, the targets are sort of being the trusted third party for all the platforms that require consumer trust. So your Airbnb or VRBO or any kind of travel site, they simply make available a link. Hey, want to confirm that the other person's property is what they say? Ask them for a certified video, and there's a little link, a little badge that's there. And the idea, like a good housekeeping seal of approval, is to put this badge everywhere. So if you're on an Amazon site or Etsy or eBay, there's a little badge that says, you're not sure? Ask the seller to send you a certified video. So travel, and then review fraud is a big one. Review, particularly with travel, booking.com, TripAdvisor, huge problems with fake reviews. Competitors come in and make them. They hire review farms out of China that have thousands and thousands of separate phones in these huge banks of walls that can generate all these reviews that skew the scores. We can prevent that because there's no way to post unless you're physically on location, which they wouldn't be able to fake. And so we can fight fake reviews with the APIs that we have. And then all the video for, you know, news organizations, like we're talking to CNN and others, they'll be able to download the images and the videos so they can put them into their, you know, video management systems. But they know that by the time it got to them, that it's clean and clear. And then you're trusting the news organization after that.
So what you're talking about is then is B2B in addition or in lieu of B2C? You gonna do both?
I would say B2B with the idea that if we can establish this umbrella brand that sort of like Underwriter Laboratories was, you all listed, or like Good Housekeeping in a sense. We're a public benefit corporation, so we're incorporated as a mission-driven company. And the idea would be that we get people aware of us through these B2B partnerships so that they see the badge and they say, oh, okay, this is something that Airbnb says I can use to protect myself. This is something eBay says I can use to protect myself. But then after they realize, oh, it's a separate thing, they could come up with other applications. So that's where I would see it bleeding into consumer, as if they, but in order to introduce them to it, we need these big partnerships to sort of validate us. Insurance companies, I think many in your listening audience that, you know, the big corporates, insurance, this is a really great way for insurance claims. This is a great way for verified listings, you know, instead of doing background checks and all the other things that you have to do. I just think it reduces costs for the companies because it now puts the onus upon the consumer to protect themselves rather than Airbnb being responsible for the content that the hosts put up.
Is the app available today and how long has it been available?
Yeah, it's available in the App Store today. It's still for iOS only because, as I said, we haven't figured out how to lock down Android yet. And it's, you know, it's pretty rudimentary at this point. It's got three parts to it. The camera, and then it forces you to map it. And then, boom, it uploads it and it has a little gallery of your past videos that you can share. And that's it. It's in the App Store under Certify It. If you look for Certify It. One word spelled like it sounds, and then we'll be on Android hopefully by next year.
I mean, is it free of charge today? Is you're still
it's 99 cents. It's 99 cents, and the reason is it's a token amount, but that's yet another check on the validity of the creator because now we know not only the device, but we have credit card. We can't see it, but we know that if needed, we could track this back to an actual human, an individual. So that's why we charge 99 cents.
Makes sense. How long you been in existence?
So the company started as something completely different. 3 months before COVID, it was a travel logging app. We launched in November 2019, and that functionality is all hidden right now, but there's a Easter egg. If you tap the profile picture 5 times, the app just blossoms into this huge fancy travel logging app with maps and storytelling and a feed and all this cool stuff that, you know, someday we it'd be fun to sort of have it out there and then have maybe word somehow get around about the Easter egg because people love that where they're like, oh, there's a secret code. It's like, you know, cheat codes.
It is kind
gaming.
Of fun. Now it makes me even more interested. So, so why do you make the pivot? I mean, you just didn't see the opportunity
So, you know, it's November right before Thanksgiving. We launch for travel. We're hoping to get some holiday travel people and, you know, we're getting some usage and stuff, but, you know, we haven't even done a press release or anything. And then COVID hits and like, nobody's going to travel. We're screwed. So anyway, you know, with COVID hit, we're like, nobody's going to be logging travel because nobody is going to be taking trips. So we
actually pivoted to real estate and got good traction. Agents used it to create real estate tours that would sit on a map in the house. So there, and because they couldn't physically tour the homes, they could sort of virtually tour the homes by walking around the map in our app and then viewing the videos of the house tours. Mm-hmm. And so we had about 5,000 realtors across the country using it until we learned what I think many people have concluded, that realtors are not absolutely in the business of transparency. They're in the business of selling properties, and our hyper-realistic videos don't make a place look big and beautiful. So once COVID wound back and they could do face-to-face tours, they went back to that, because they otherwise, when they put something up, it's a video, they want it to be fisheye and super clean.
Do you have any business-to-business clients now that you're partnering with?
So just literally got the app pivoted over and all that functionality hidden in January. So just now, setting out to first target is, I think, Airbnb, and then a dating like Tinder. I think those two are super obvious ones, because everyone has their horror stories with Tinder dates. And a lot of people have horror stories with booking trips on Airbnb and being surprised by what they got.
So I got a few more questions, but anything else you want to say on the technology behind it before we pivot? I want to ask you a few questions on what you mentioned earlier, investing and your investors and that kind of stuff.
Oh yeah.
But anything from a technology perspective?
Yeah, no, I mean, other than just to know that everything we're built on AWS and Google Cloud services, you know, totally scalable, totally safe, totally private, totally secure. And so, you know, I feel like we've got a pretty rock solid offering for iPhone, and our hope is to, but that's it from a tech point of view. You know, one other thing, that the tangent we won't go down, is that it also, because of all the metadata correlated with the HD video, it's excellent training data for AI image, you know, generators for the future, because it's all standardized.
Well, that was kind of actually a question I had. You've pivoted maybe twice on this. Are you going to pivot again? And I could see you pivoting.
We'll pivot as often as we need to. One of the things I've learned is, you know, I mentioned this earlier, good products are not invented, they're discovered. And if you look at so many, you know, products that we use today, they didn't start that way at all. Like Slack was an internal tool used by a failed gaming company called TinySpec. Their game failed, but they had raised a bunch of money and they built this internal tool, and they're like, well, let's throw that one up and see if that sticks. And it stuck. Twitter was a podcasting company, and then when Apple Podcasts came out, they offered to give the money back to investors. Some regretting it deeply took the money back, but most said, we'll let it run with it. And that ultimately became iterated around until it became Twitter. And so that is the key to entrepreneurial success. One of the predictors is persistence. It is that you keep learning and learning and iterating on real customers until they tell you what you need to be building. And then when that happens, you know it in an instant, because things take off. That happened with my last company, Line 2, where this was before texting was cool with business people. It's hard to even imagine, but if you think about a couple of decades ago or a decade ago, that was texting was for family and friends. It was kind of intimate. You wouldn't text a business professional that you didn't know, right? And so we had the app in the market, but it didn't have texting yet. And the customer's like, we want texting. I said, but this is for a business line. It's like a PBX line that you're adding to your phone. No, we want texting. So we listened to customers. We added texting. And
then suddenly New York Times wrote a huge piece about it. And we were the third most downloaded app in the App Store. And we grew from nothing to 7 million in revenue in 18 months. Mm-hmm. All because texting was what was missing. That's what they wanted. And
it's a great story.
So, yeah. So that's why we'll pivot again if we need to. And I have very patient investors. But I do think that, you know, this opportunity is going to become more and more apparent to people. You know, I love to look at the counter side of big trends. So, all right, generative AI is exploding right now. Okay, so what are the implications of that? So, yeah, everyone's rushing to build generative AI startups. I'm like, what are the startups that need to exist where in a world where generative AI runs rampant? And that's sort of my, I kind of take a contrarian view of it that way. And so my vision is that, oh, people are going to need something where they absolutely 100% know that it's true, if that's even possible. They're going to need something to prove things are real, because photo today, seeing is not believing, and seeing is deceiving, because your brain's wired to, if you see it like a video, your brain thinks you saw it. And 10 years later, you're going to remember that you saw it potentially, even though it was a video. So you have to be really careful with video, because it really tricks your brain into believing it if you're not paying attention.
I've often thought, yeah, it's like throwing a dartboard at the wall and then moving the dartboard to where the dart is. I mean, that's how you find out what's going to happen. And Slack's
that is a great analogy, a metaphor. I love that. That's apt.
So look, one thing you mentioned earlier, I'm curious to pick your brain on. We probably could have a podcast in entirety on this, but simply, I mean, we'll keep it short, but you mentioned the investors always win, and you mentioned also your learnings. Look, I've got friends in the business, and one thing I know is that, yeah, the founder, at least every case that I've seen, is the last one out. Mm-hmm. So, and he was in this case too, which is always, it can be great. It can be not so good by the time everybody else takes their share. Thoughts on what you've learned?
Yeah, it really does boil down to being very careful about the choices you make in terms of who you decide to work with. So there, I mean, this is absolutely true and sounds crazy story, but after Microsoft bought my last company, two companies ago, Telio, they wanted me to come work for them. I said no. So they said, okay, you have to sign a non-compete. They wanted 2 years. I granted one. So for 1 year, I could not work in the internet industry, which is my business. So, and I had finally made some money. So I took the year off and traveled. And when I came back from that travel, at the end of that travel, I was in Burma, of all places, on an overnight riverboat on the Irrawaddy River, headed to from Yangon to Rangoon to Yangon, blah, blah, blah. Crazy. Wow. And on this riverboat is this absolutely charming guy with his wife and two absolutely charming kids. And, you know, it's a nice boat. And so there's only 16 of us. It's sort of like you see in an old, like, British movie about colonial times. But anyway, so we have dinner and we're chatting. And, you know, I mentioned I just sold a company in Microsoft, and he got all interested. He put the first $250,000 in. Long story short, he wasn't who he said it was. It wasn't his money. And in the end, It was a whole bunch of other people's money that he needed to pay back. And so in 2009-10, right after, as we had gone to 7 million run rate, he's like needing to sell. And I'm like, WTF, I mean, this is inflection. This is not when you sell, you know, we're on the path for something much bigger. And that would have been fine, except that the other investor was a kind of private equity type out of Norway that was mostly in shipping and wood, you know, forestry and minerals mining, cyclic stuff that's heavily exposed. And in 2010-11, if you recall, the 2009 meltdown of the U.S. had spread globally and there was a macroeconomic decline. Those industries got tanked. So that firm said, let's shut down that stupid investment fund and liquidate. So now I had two investors, one with 25%, one with 35%, who had self-interested reasons unrelated to the company for selling. That's illegal, but they're both offshore. And so they took the company and tried to sell it, couldn't. And 5 years later, hadn't grown it. It was still 7 million run rate. And so they sold it to a company that I had already introduced them to for exactly twice the amount invested, because that was what their liquidation preference was. So they didn't even try to get a little bit for the common. They just got exactly their money back times two. So they got double their money back and left zero for me. And the only thing that helped is because I knew that company and made the introduction, they required me to sign off on the sale. But then it was like a brinksmanship game. And I was able to get them to add $500,000 for the common shareholders. So I got about 30% of that. And then the rest of the company got that. So I got a little bit for the employees. But that's just, you know, there's reasons to be very careful about who you pick. And, you know, as this guy that I met on the river, next thing I know, I'm in Hong Kong. He's staying at like the peninsula with like two suites with four bedrooms. So his kids have rooms. He's ordering $3,000 bottles of wine. And he introduces me to Richard Lee, who is the son or nephew, I think, of Li Keqing, the richest billionaire in China. And he's a Hong Kong multi-gazillionaire. And next thing I know, Richard Lee is coming to my danky Sheraton, and the Sheraton people are all panicked and they have to like clear an entire floor and set up a perimeter. And I meet with this guy for 30 minutes and an hour actually. And he picks my brain and then gives me some PCCW golf balls, which I still have as a souvenir. But so anyway, this guy was introducing me to these people and it all was none of his people.
It all checked out, huh?
But none of it ended up checking out in the end.
Yeah, at the end of the day. Well, how did he have all those connections then?
He was a private equity hedge fund type, wheeler dealer, global globetrotter. I think he just would burn bridges and then find new people because he literally was all over the world. And his investments came from Malta and Isle of Man and, you know, all of these offshore tax havens. And they came from different people in tiny little amounts. I'm like, wait a minute. And, you know, he was always arguing to tranche into tiny little tranches. Well, that's because he needed the time to pull together the money from these people. It's fascinating. There's a case now that is taught at Tuck Business School all about it because it's such a textbook case.
This one specifically?
Yeah, the Line 2 case.
Wow.
It's, yeah.
You have learned a lot.
Yeah. Well, and that's why it's the best thing that could ever happen in a sense. I mean, yeah, sure, I'd love to be a gazillionaire, but honestly, I don't think that they're necessarily happier. And I learned, and you learn a lot more from struggles and overcoming those struggles than you do when things just get easy.
So is that, is it probably oversimplified to say then your number one recommendation is just know damn good and well who you're doing business with?
Know damn good well who you're doing business with. When you're negotiating the terms, everybody's happy and you're all lovey-dovey and your friends. And so it's sort of, it feels almost uncomfortable to like poison the relationship by saying, well, you know, in the actual contract, we should probably have protections, blah, blah, in case. But it's like, you know, we're kind of like, oh, you would never do that type of thing. You know, where you're trying to show trust by, but I did the one thing I, so to summarize the advice, yes, choose very carefully. Two, you know, really use the term sheets to protect yourself. And for example, I did when the, after the thing took off, then they wanted to put more money in. So they put in another 2 million. And when they did that, I was in charge. So I named the terms. And one of those terms was that if they're late on any of the tranches, because of course John wanted it in tranches, that the shares go in as common. So I protected myself there to make sure they would pay me on time because John was always late. And then the second thing that I did that I regret to this day is I, what I did do is I expanded the board from 5 to 7 because they had 3 seats amongst the two of them. And as a 5-person board, they had majority. They agreed to add 2 independents. So I could have added 2 independents to have a 7-person board, and they would not have had the majority they needed to take over the company. I never filled those seats, even though that was the reason I was smart enough to negotiate that that those extra seats to protect myself. But things are going so well, and we're all so happy and trusting that I never bothered to fill them. And then when things turned and suddenly John needed money and he ganged up with the other guys who wanted to shut down their fund, I was screwed at that point. That was over.
I've heard, yeah. Look, I think it's more of a common story than it would appear. Yeah. Because
the news is all about the Jack Dorsey's and the, you know, all the people that get on top of a rocket ship and ride it to great success. I have great respect for those people, but also many of them didn't learn a lot along the way because, you know, when you're that lucky on your first try and it gets that big, you really haven't learned a lot on your journey about businesses when you don't get lucky like that, which is 99% of them.
Fantastic. All right. Thank you for that story. That was terrific. A good, good learning story, Peter. Where can folks reach you? I know we could keep going. Where can folks reach you and where can they reach Certify It?
So if you look for me on LinkedIn, I'm happy to connect or you can follow me. It's Peter Sisson spelled, I think. Well, I'm sure it'll be in the show notes how to spell my name. Yep. And you can reach out to me there. The company is at certifyit.org. We are, as I said, a public mission benefit company. Certifyit.org has more information about the company and links to the App Store, but also within the Apple App Store. If you just Google Certifyit, not Google, but search for Certifyit one word, you'll see the app and you can install it. Yes, it charges 99 cents, but that's just to make sure that you're legit. We don't make a lot of money and it's only one time.
Yeah, I wouldn't imagine. how many users do you have? Can you say?
We had 5,000-ish. Some of them are left over from real estate and are still using it to do tours.
Yeah.
And they still have the full version of the old app with the maps and everything.
Are you a wine guy, given you sold off to wine.com?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a wine snob. And after, you know, that sale happened in 2005-ish. So I was a wine guy at the beginning, and then as I haven't had an income since then, I became less of a wine guy. So now I'm drinking, you know, the stuff that I can get for under $12.
Great. And a few words on being an adventure traveler and aviation enthusiast.
I would just say I encourage every young person or every person, because I did it midlife too, but to use your 20s to take a little time to go see the world. I did it. I did volunteer work for 2 years, kind of a Peace Corps type of thing, and then had 1 year where I just backpacked. I had $8,000 and I was able to travel for 1 year, hitting, you know, everywhere from Burma to India to Thailand, Australia, Indonesia, Ethiopia, South America, all over the world. And that was the best education I could have had as a young person. So I just, that's like my advice is if you can take a break and travel, it just allows you to get a perspective that really helps that, you yeah. understand the world and makes it easier for you to understand other people, I think.
Do you have a book you like to recommend?
That's a great question. The books I would recommend would be, you know, adventure books rather than business books.
That's okay.
Yeah, well, one of my favorite stories is about Ernest Shackleton, who is a British explorer who got marooned in the Antarctic. The ice crushed his boat, and then the boat sank, and him and his crew are standing on ice that's melting. Long story short, every one of his crew survived. He literally got them on an island, and then with a couple people rowed out on a boat across the Arctic Sea or wherever the hell to get to an island and to find an encampment. And 2 years later, brought back a boat to rescue his men who were all still alive. So amazing story of leadership and perseverance. And that's it's called Endurance, a perfect 5-star rating with 18,000 ratings. It's just a really good book and an amazing story about Great. Leadership. So I recommend that.
All right, I'll get it. Last question, what do you do for fun?
Well, I geek out on my flight simulator. I have an A350. It's not a room size one yet. That's what I would have spent my money on at Billions. I literally would have bought an actual certified training flight simulator for like a A350 or 787. But so I fly my virtual planes around and then literally fly all the time just because I can't stop traveling.
That's awesome. Well, thank you for being here. Great stories. I wish all the success to Certify It. And look, if your history is any indication of your future, worst case, you'll pivot and you'll be off again to another buyout or something. Hopefully you go IPO on this one.
Yeah, I don't give up. So we'll find something somewhere. It was a pleasure to be here, Al. I really enjoyed the convo, and let's keep in touch.
Absolutely. I've already sent you my LinkedIn request.
Sweet. I'll connect
All now. Right. Thank you, my friend. And to you listeners, please hit us on almartintalksdata@gmail.com. Love to hear from you. Until next time, we'll see you on the podcast.